Hi there, I'm Greg from Kapow. Visit us at kapow.com to check out our unique collection of everyday reusable products designed to help you do more with less. C-U-P-P-O-W.com.
I'm Linda Palacio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
What's as American as apple pie and still illegal in the U.S.? Find out on today's episode of Eating Matters. Hi, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liut, and we're broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn on Heritage Radio Network. Okay, so what's as American as apple pie? According to advocates, the answer is hemp, a variety of the cannabis sativa plant. I probably mispronounced that. But anyway, the cultivation of which is currently illegal in the U.S. The Guardian published a piece on hemp this past Sunday, claiming that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams all grew hemp, which was used for things like paper, rope, cloth. The first flag of the U.S., sewn by Betsy Ross, is said to have been made from hemp, and the Declaration of Independence was drafted on hemp paper. Today, we're going to be speaking with Eric Steenstra and Amy DeFault about the benefits of this plant and what advocates are doing to make its cultivation legal in the U.S. Later on the show, we'll be joined by Jesse Gould from Oxford, our featured Startup of the Week. But before we get into our discussion on hemp, I want to go over some of the biggest food policy stories from the past week. First up, I want to talk about Philadelphia. Last Wednesday, the city made history as their city council advanced a proposal to tax sugary drinks, which will fund universal pre-K in the city. This is a measure that would make Philly the country's first major city in the U.S. to impose such a quote, sin tax on sugar sweetened beverages. There was some back and forth about the exact rate that was going to be put forward, and the final decision by the council came to a 1.5 cents per ounce tax, which was a little bit down from the 3 cents per ounce tax rate that Mayor Jim Kenney proposed back in March. But the proposal will still bring in an estimated $91 million per year, and interestingly, also applies to diet drinks. The measure will face one more vote before being finalized. The vote happens tomorrow, but most people are expecting the city council to officially seal the deal and move forward. This is a huge win for the public health community, and it was no doubt made possible by things like the nation's first soda tax happening in Berkeley, California. I think we can expect to see a lot more of these proposals popping up throughout the country and actually passing, which is a big sea change from where we were a year or two ago. Moving on, I want to talk about SNAP, always. So there were two compelling studies on food access that were recently released that I want to mention. The first is a USDA Amber Waves report on food deserts, which found that both high and low-income households consider store characteristics other than proximity in deciding where to shop. So this study is interesting because much of the research, the prior research on food store access, assumed that those in food deserts were constrained by their local food environment and were therefore forced to rely on the smaller stores in their neighborhood that tend to have higher prices and less variety, especially less variety of fresh produce. So this study used data from the USDA's National Household Food Acquisition and Purchase Survey, which is a mouthful, so we're just going to call that Food Apps, the acronym. Researchers use this data to examine where U.S. households actually shop, how far the store is from their home, what mode of transportation they use, and found some interesting things. So in terms of their key findings, they found that households often bypass the nearest supermarket to obtain groceries. And this behavior is consistent across transportation modes, suggesting that U.S. households are not, in fact, as limited by the food stores in their own neighborhoods. It also found that roughly 90% of those households that participate in the SNAP program and the WIC program and or the WIC program did their primary grocery shopping in a supermarket or a super center. So other factors, basically this is all to say other factors such as household and neighborhood resources, education, and taste preferences are thought to be maybe more important determinants of food choice than proximity. I wanted to bring this up this week because you will remember last week in our conversation with Chuck Abbott, we talked about the updated proposed SNAP retailer requirements. And one of the arguments against changing these requirements for stores, which would require the stores to stock healthier food, would mean that smaller retailer establishments like convenience stores and bodegas would be forced to drop out of the program, thus resulting in fewer options of local places for SNAP recipients to shop. So in a way, this study can be used to support the USDA's proposal, as it finds that most people don't rely on the closest store option, and most SNAP recipients do a lot of their, most of their shopping at a traditional supermarket. And speaking of household resources, the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities released a new study recently that found that food stamp recipients would buy more nutritious foods, notably vegetables, poultry, and fish, if benefits were raised by just $1 a day, or 24%. So my hope is that studies like these can be used to support the argument for more food assistance in this country. Unfortunately, Congress has taken a more fiscally conservative approach to federal nutrition programs recently. For instance, the 2014 farm law called for an $8 billion reduction in food stamp spending over 10 years, which granted it's smaller than the proposed $40 billion cuts that conservatives thought, but is a cut nonetheless. So just a few other facts before I wrap up my conversation on SNAP. A reminder, 44.3 million people receive food stamps as of today with an average benefit of $126.26 per month, which is about $4 per person per day. And fun fact, enrollment has declined for 4 months in a row now. Moving on, last week, Iowa Senator Joni Ernst tried to insert language into the National Defense Authorization Act that would continue to offer meat options that meet or exceed the standards established in the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. This was a thinly veiled attempt to block the Humane Society's Meatless Monday campaign, which is working to get institutions like the military, hospitals, schools to reduce its meat consumption. It goes without saying, but I'm just going to say it anyways. Senator Ernst has close ties to animal agriculture, which is obviously one of the biggest businesses in her state, and has received thousands from organizations like the National Pork Producers Council towards her campaigns in the past. Luckily, in my opinion at least, the Senate passed the measure yesterday and failed to include her amendment. And finally, yesterday, we're going to move on to North Dakota. By a 3-1 margin, North Dakotans refused to allow corporate hog and dairy farming, keeping a blanket ban on corporate ownership that dates back to 1932. The referendum overturned a law passed last year by the Republican-controlled legislature to relax the ban by allowing out-of-state corporations to own hog and dairy farms covering up to 1 square mile. Proponents of the statewide ban said that it protects family sized farms from the deep pockets of outside investors, while those in support of the exemption for hog and dairy farms say it would broaden the financing available to livestock producers and help them modernize. According to the Associated Press, 9 states restrict corporate farming, but most have some sort of exceptions for livestock producers. And that wraps it up for our new segment today. Be sure to tweet or direct message us at EatMattersHRN if you would like to include a particular policy update or have thoughts on the ones we discussed today. Okay. Turning to the topic at hand, today we'll be discussing all things hemp. Joining me on the line to do so are my two guests, Eric Steenstra and Amy Dufault. Eric is the executive director of the Hemp Industries Association, a membership-based nonprofit trade group representing the interests of the hemp industry. And Amy is the director of communications at the Brooklyn Fashion and Design Accelerator and has been a sustainable fashion writer for over 2 decades. Eric and Amy, welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you both for coming on. Amy, we'll kick it off with you. Can you just, we'll start the very, very beginning. Can you just describe for our listeners what hemp actually is?
Yeah, well, it's many things, but it's funny. The more you read about it, the more you understand it is not marijuana.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
It's a fast-growing plant that grows faster than most weeds. It can grow about 15 to 20 feet high, and it can be used for everything from textiles to food, from body care products to building materials, and has been around since time began.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
my quick soundbite for
right,
you.
Right, right. That sounds almost too good to be true. Can you give us maybe some specific product examples? I recently read an op-ed that Elizabeth Kucinich wrote in The Hill, kind of talking about the mirrored benefits that you kind of hinted at of hemp. And I'm wondering if you can kind of give us some examples of how hemp is used.
Well, I mean, it's used in a lot of a variety of foods and different oils and textiles like rope and hemp.
Are the oils edible?
Rope and canvas. And it's used in clothing. It's actually used in so many different products, from beauty products to food to fashion. It's amazing the more you do research and that you can find out what hemp is actually used in or can be used in.
Yeah.
Versus things like cotton or petroleum-based oils.
Eric?
They're used in beauty products.
Eric, do you have any other examples that you want to throw in there just to sort of help set the stage?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. So some other good examples that a lot of people don't even realize is that hemp's being used pretty extensively now in auto parts, for example.
Really?
Composite materials are being made from hemp fiber and replacing fiberglass, and you know, major auto manufacturers like BMW and Ford and Mercedes and Volkswagen are all using these in their cars, and make the car lighter, and they perform better, especially in crash tests. And it's a recyclable material at the end of its life as compared to fiberglass. So that's been one really neat application. There's also building materials. I think Amy mentioned that, but maybe expand on that a little bit. There's a material called hempcrete that is made with a mixture of the hemp herd or the woody core of the stalk when it's mixed with lime and water, and it produces a sustainable, non-toxic, naturally breathable, and naturally mold-resistant material that has really excellent insulative properties. They've been using it in Europe and France and the UK and some other areas of Europe for a number of years now, but it's just been starting to come to the U.S. and we're seeing a few projects here. And I think, long term, it'll be a great material that'll really help out the U.S. building industry.
Wow. And it's also edible. Are the oils that Amy mentioned edible, or is that for a different application?
Yeah, no, so they would be. So that would be the seed oil. So when you take the seed is very nutritious. It's high in omega-3 and omega-6 essential fatty acids, which are those good fats that doctors like to recommend for health. It's also an excellent plant-based source of protein. And when you crush the seed, it produces a very nice oil. It can be used in salad dressings and other types of edible, baked goods, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It also can be used in industrial products or in cosmetics and body care products. So it's pretty versatile.
Yeah, to say the least. Okay, so so one of the things that Amy alluded to was that people think hemp is synonymous with marijuana. And indeed, in doing my background research and just in having conversations with people, I think there is a common misinterpretation still that you can maybe get high from hemp. So Eric, I'm wondering, can you officially, for the record, debunk this? And
no problem. So, a lot of people, the federal government began sort of demonizing marijuana in the 1930s, and at that point they didn't really understand the differences between hemp varieties of cannabis and drug type or marijuana varieties, and so it kind of got lumped in there. And so after 75, 80 years of misinformation, a lot of people do have that sort of misperception. But Yeah, I like to, you know, sort of tell people it's, you know, like the difference between sweet corn and field corn, or a, you know, a Chihuahua and a St. Bernard. You know, they're
yeah.
both dogs, but they're very different types of dogs. Same goes for hemp. It's, you know, has such a small amount of the psychoactive part of the plant, which is the tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, in it. It's typically, by law, less than 0.3%. And even scientifically, to say it's under 1%, you really couldn't get high with it. So marijuana types of cannabis would have, you know, anywhere from 5 to 20% THC. So even if you smoke hemp, you're just going to, you know, likely get a headache.
That does not sound like fun. Are there other plants that are commonly used today that you can, in fact, get high from, that you can draw a comparison to for our listeners? Yeah,
it's interesting. The you know, a lot of people, you know, regularly consume, you know, poppy seeds, for example,
right
on your bagels or on a muffin. And of course, poppy is also a plant that produces opiates, and that is controlled. So it's another great example of a plant where it has, you know, very positive beneficial uses, but also can be used as a drug in certain types of the, you know, varieties of the poppy.
Right. Okay, so let me see if I have this right. We can purchase goods made with hemp in this country, but we can't grow or produce it. Is that right?
Right.
Sort of, yes. So up until 2014, the law did not distinguish whatsoever between hemp and marijuana. It just said all cannabis plants are illegal, but it had an exception that said that, like, certain parts of the plant, for example, the stalk and the fiber from the stalk, or the seed if it's been processed in a way that it won't grow, those were legal to import. And so, you know, a lot of companies here in the United States actually were importing hemp, and we have over $500 million industry based on entirely on imports.
Wow.
Now, in 2014, Congress passed a new version of the Farm Bill and included a provision in there. It's called Section 7606, and it basically defined industrial hemp and then allowed for research and pilot programs under the State Departments of Agriculture and under universities. So we've seen some limited, research programs and pilot programs that have started to happen in a number of states, but that's the only legal hemp that's available today. Most, if a farmer just wants to grow it commercially,
mm-hmm.
that's not allowed.
Okay, so to help us, I want to help listeners understand a little bit more. You know, put sort of hemp in context. We've talked a little bit about about the benefits and the possible uses, but I want to kind of drill down on this, and let's compare hemp to a different fiber. So, Amy, this is kind of your area of expertise. I'm wondering if you can talk us through a little bit about the benefits of hemp over, let's say, cotton. From a fiber perspective?
Well, there's so many, but I mean, growing hemp has so many positive ecological and economic benefits, but, you know, a lot of the times in the fashion industry, we're using kind of these constant sound bites, like it takes, you know, more than 5,000 gallons of water to produce 2 pounds of cotton.
Wow.
And I know, you know, that makes a t-shirt and a pair of jeans. So if you even just think about it, just like that, but
that's a pretty effective soundbite, by the way.
Water used for cotton and hemp, I believe, and Eric could probably correct me, but that it's about half the amount of water for growing hemp that you would use for cotton. And I know, and even with hemp, like the fabric doesn't wear out as fast, and antibacterial properties of hemp as a fabric versus cotton. But I think just the amount of pesticides too that are being used to grow cotton, where hemp has a lot of natural insecticides or kind of pesticides built in. Bugs just don't really like it.
Mm-hmm.
So between like the amount of pesticides and water that's being used to grow cotton, non-organic cotton, as much as organic cotton, you know, like when you're looking at the difference between growing non-organic cotton versus something like hemp, it's such a no-brainer to think about wanting to invest more in hemp just for the environment.
Right. What about from a price perspective? Are they similar, or would they be similar?
I would imagine that hemp at this point, and again, Eric is like the guru, the hemp guru here, but I would imagine that with anything, I mean, hemp's been around forever, but it would be a new crop here in the United States that we'd be investing in. So as with anything, when it's a new material, you would be spending more on it, is my guess on that.
Eric, what do you think?
So I mean, Amy's right. It's a new material in the sense that we haven't been growing it here for 75 or 80 years. And so, a lot of all the genetics that we had, the old hemp that they used to grow, that's all been lost. All the processing equipment is no longer here. The infrastructure is gone, right? So we have to start over rebuilding it as an industry. But yet, hemp is very old in that, it was a crop that was grown going back to the founding fathers, of our country and going back thousands of years all the way to China. So it's, it's not a new crop in that sense, but I think in terms of the sustainability side, it's, it is significantly better than cotton in terms of its water usage. Yeah, it uses significantly less water. And certainly the pesticides, I understand that cotton is the most heavily sprayed agricultural crop on the planet with over 25% of all the pesticides going into that. So it's definitely not a very environmentally friendly crop. And then the other thing about hemp that's interesting is that you can grow it in all 50 states, whereas cotton is really a southern crop.
Right.
You're not going to see people growing it in, North Dakota or Maine or something like that. So it's a little more versatile there, too.
I have a question. You mentioned sort of the fact that hemp is kind of, you don't have to use as many pesticides. Is that just because it isn't grown? And so it isn't grown in the U.S. And so there haven't been the kind of pests or weeds that have sprung up to inhibit its growth? Or is it something more innate in the plant that causes it?
Yeah, I think it's more, unique to the plant. I mean, for one thing, we could take an example like Canada, right? They weren't growing hemp for a long time. And they started about 15 years ago, and they're now, growing about, they grew about 100,000 acres last year, and, there's no pesticides that are even approved for the plant, so I know that they're not using them, but even in talking to farmers up there, there's very little pest issues, and I think part of that may be just the type of plant that it is. It's a taller, more hardy plant than cotton, but also the cannabinoids and some of the production of resins and flowers, I think, tends to deter pests as well. But it's not completely pest-free. There are some pests that will go after it. But it's just, I'm not aware of any part of the world where hemp's being grown and they're spraying pesticides on the crop.
Okay. All right. I'm gonna take a pause here. We're going to take a quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into some of the current legislative proposals to legalize hemp production in the U.S. and what's at stake with legalization. Stay tuned.
Americans throw away 58 billion disposable cups every year. A lot of those cups will still be around long after you're dead. Kind of dark, I know, but I'm Greg from Kapow, and we decided to do something about it. We created the only glass travel mug that's 100% U.S. made. You can check it out alongside our complete line of everyday reusables at kapow.com, C-U-P-P-O-W.com.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today we're speaking with Eric Steenstra and Amy Default about legalizing hemp cultivation in the U.S. Before we went to break, we were talking about cotton, and I kind of want to pick up that thread, no pun intended.
Oh, God.
Sorry, I had to. Anyway, so last week we reported that the USDA was going to pay $300 million to cotton producers to help sort of stabilize the industry that's seen a lot of declines due to an increased globalized supply. And I'm wondering if what we just heard from Amy, that, which was basically that hemp could be a great alternative to cotton in a lot of ways. I'm wondering, Eric, if you think that the cotton industry or any similar industry that stands to lose from legalizing hemp production is working to sort of block some of your legislative efforts to legalize this crop.
You know, we haven't, I'm not aware of any efforts by the cotton industry to come, you know, to go after hemp, you know, so I think at this point, you know, most of the push is to grow hemp here in the United States. And as we, you know, as we all probably know, the textile industry here in the United States has been devastated by, you know, textiles from where other countries where they have much cheaper labor overseas. So I don't know. I mean, cotton is still grown here and exported to other countries. So maybe that, you know, there's a factor there. But one of the things I feel like with hemp, I think you know, we've seen a lot of excellent hemp textiles coming out of China. And I think that they'll continue to be blended with cotton and other fabrics and, you know, and whatnot. But I don't know. I think that hemp here in the United States is going to probably be more a little bit more of an industrial fiber. I think maybe that'll be more of the focus. Things like composites or other high-tech applications might be more of what we would see here domestically. That's just my opinion, but you know, we'll have to see how the industry develops.
And can you tell us, like, what, Eric, how large of an industry in total that, you know, hemp could potentially represent?
Well, right now, the Hemp Industries Association does an annual estimate of the size of the market, and we estimated for 2015 that the total retail sales of hemp products was about $575 to $600 million.
Wow.
So, you know, that's, again, based entirely on imports. So we feel like, you know, we've seen significant, like, double-digit growth each year over the last 7 or 8 years that we've been tracking this. And so, I think we could see this grow to a $1 billion market within, you know, 5 or 6 years.
Wow. And Amy, the economic benefits of hemp is something that you have studied. Is that right? Can you tell us?
Oh, you know, I know a little bit of this, a little bit of that about a lot of things. But you know, you just got me thinking, Eric. When, you know, I was actually at a cotton conference 2 months ago down in Raleigh, and I had this guy who was a cotton broker kind of lean over and ask me why I thought cotton wasn't being sold as much as it had been in the past. And it was a lot of the blends that they're doing now are these synthetic blends that are making fibers that are plant-based, like cotton, and I would imagine like hemp as well, to be this sort of looked at as a luxury fiber in terms of apparel. Because it's the same thing as you know, this cheapening of food, putting in junky products in food. And it's the same thing as in fashion, you know, we have these like mixed synthetic fibers so that the fibers can't even stand on their own anymore. I'm excited to see what's going to happen with hemp moving forward, just to see if it is, like Eric said, going to be used in kind of more high tech applications. Which is funny thinking about hemp in that way, like a high tech,
yeah, you don't
application,
realize,
but. Yeah, I mean, it's suddenly going to be this whole, hopefully a whole new industry and not just research plots through universities, that actual farmers can be farming it without being fearful that they're going to be shut down by the government because there just might be, you know, more than just hemp growing out in their fields. And I think that's a big fear right now with farmers, like, why invest in something that's
illegal.
That might just get torn apart. You can't invest in something like that. It's too risky.
Yeah, and that's a great point, Amy. We're still at that point now where there's a few producers that are kind of on the cutting edge that are wading into this a little bit. But you're right. Most farmers are going to sit on the sidelines, and you know, hemp's not a commodity crop yet, and it's not proven what the market is, and you know, we don't have the infrastructure and all these things. So there's some hurdles for us to get over. But I do think there's interesting. There's a researcher at Clarkson University in New York who came up with a way to take the hemp bast fiber, the fiber on that sort of the outside that's being used like for textiles, that type of thing, and use that and convert it into a material that was replacement for graphene, which could be used in supercapacitors. When I heard about this, I read about it, I was just blown away because, you know, nobody really thinks of hemp in those terms. They think about, you know, rope and canvas and, like more traditional products. And so I think those kinds of potential applications and, you know, things like the composites for the auto industry, those are really opening eyes and making people think again, hey, you know, plant-based resource like this could really have some incredible applications. Could be something really important.
Yeah. Eric, what is a strategy from your perspective, the association's perspective, to move the needle on advancing legislation that would make this possible? Can you tell us about maybe where some of the proposals are currently pending and what they're asking to do?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been building some good support in Congress. I think the biggest hurdle that we need to jump over right now is to get Congress to pass legislation that would fully remove hemp from the Controlled Substances Act and then allow states just to regulate it like any other, you know, crop. And so we have two bills that are currently pending in Congress. There's H.R. 525 in the House that currently has 70 co-sponsors, including, you know, a nice bipartisan support. You know, quite a few Republicans and Democrats are on the bill.
Yeah.
And so that's been growing, you know, 70 co-sponsors, pretty nice amount there. And then in the Senate, there's a bill called S-134, and that bill was actually introduced by Senator Wyden of Oregon, along with Senator McConnell, the majority leader.
And that's Senator Mitch McConnell.
For, yeah,
that's incredible.
Senator McConnell has become a major proponent of this. And I mean, we just had this big celebration last week. We do an annual industry promotion called Hemp History Week. And during Hemp History Week, Senator McConnell and Senator Wyden and Senator Paul and Merkley putting this resolution on the Senate floor to commemorate Hemp History Week and talk about the economic potential, and it passed unanimously. So I feel like we're making some progress. We're just not quite there yet, but definitely some exciting things that are happening.
So it's interesting to me. So you guys decided to focus on like a federal plan of attack first, as opposed to what, you know, let's say like the marijuana industry is doing, which is kind of targeting like individual states. And the hope is that once a certain number of individual states have legalized marijuana or medical marijuana, that the federal government would be forced to act. What made you decide to go the federal route first?
Well, we've been focusing sort of a dual-pronged attack, you know, both in terms of the state and the federal level. And, you know, one of our goals was to educate legislators at the state level, because a lot of them end up, after serving in their state legislatures, they end up coming to Washington.
Yeah.
So by educating them there, they would bring that knowledge forward. I mean, we had long, you know, years ago, we had a bill in Illinois, for example, that then State Senator Barack Obama voted in favor of. Now, you know, those are the kinds of things, you know, when they have a chance to consider something like that and then bring it forward. A number of the legislators are in Congress now. We started working with at the state level. So, and actually, we had a number of states that did pass some legislation before anything happened at the federal level. But a lot of states did sit on the sidelines because they were saying, well, why should we do anything? The federal government's just, you know, illegal. So once the Farm Bill passed in 2014, we had like 10 states that had legislation at that point. Since then, we've had 19 more states come on board, and so now there's 29 states with legislation that allows them to, you know, to move forward and take advantage of this. So it's kind of snowballed,
right? As typically happens. Amy, can you tell us what's happening in the fashion world? You know, what people are doing in that industry to promote the legalization of hemp?
Yeah, there was actually a great documentary that Patagonia just came out with last week called Growing Warriors. That was awesome. And it was, you know, just a little 12-minute documentary on this kind of veteran to farmer training organization.
Mm-hmm.
And then Fibershed, which is a company on the West Coast that does many things, including creating fiber sheds all over the country, but also regenerative textiles in California. But so, you know, here's Patagonia got behind something that was on this Kentucky hemp farmer and his story of coming back from fighting in the military and just wanting to stay on his land and grow hemp. So it's kind of like this beautiful documentary on his journey with it. But it's pretty cool to me to see people like Patagonia, who are always at the forefront anyway of you know, pioneering innovation and sustainability, but that they wanted to get behind something like this and just put a spotlight on it. I mean, the more we have large brands in the fashion industry like Patagonia, like Eileen Fisher, mm-hmm. who are supporting sustainability and textiles, I mean, it just gets it into the every man speak, and we're able to talk about it and give it more legitimacy than just, you know, mm-hmm. the old hemp shops, you know, on the old main streets in places like Burlington, Vermont, or, you know, it's like, it's hemp. Hemp is becoming a lot more sophisticated, even though it's, again, like we said at the beginning of all this, it's this fiber that's been around since time began, but suddenly it's this whole new fiber we're looking at. But so anyways, it's exciting to see companies like Patagonia getting behind it.
Yeah, great.
I'm so glad you brought that up, Amy. That is a really an excellent piece that Patagonia put together, and actually the farmer who's featured in that piece, Mike Lewis, he's a former veteran from Kentucky who's now got a small family farm in central Kentucky, and he's actually going to be in New York City this Friday speaking at an event at the Javits Center, and that is it's an incredible piece. I definitely recommend anyone that's listening to go out and look that up. The I think if you probably search hemp in Patagonia, you'd probably come up with it. So it's a really excellent.
Oh, great. And Eric, any information for our listeners where they can go to learn more on the legislative proposals or get their two cents in?
Absolutely, yeah. So if anybody's interested to find out more, but more importantly to take action, because that's what we really need at this point is, you know, people writing their members of Congress and letting them know where they stand on the issue. Mm-hmm. They could go to votehemp.com/takeaction, and there's a sort of pre-written letters there, or information on how to call your legislator if you want to reach out to them and talk to them about supporting these bills that we have pending.
Oh, great. All right. I'm going to have to, unfortunately, leave it there for our discussion of hemp. I could talk about this all day. I think it is just so fascinating, and I'm really excited to see what the future holds in store for this industry. For more on hemp legislation, like Eric said, go to votehemp.com/take action, and you can also read more about sustainable fashion written by Amy, fabulous pieces by Amy, at bkaccelerator.com. Eric and Amy, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for having us.
All right. Yep, that's right. You know what time it is. Time for a new segment, the Startup of the Week, where we feature an innovative and exciting new food organization at the end of each episode. And with that, I'm pleased to introduce Jesse Gould, founder and CEO of Oxvert, a seasonal and sustainably sourced catering company based in New York City. Jesse, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be on.
I'm very happy to have you. Can you tell us a little bit about the company and how it works?
Sure. So we are an office catering company, and we make and serve lunch to offices and groups across Manhattan, with a large focus on local sourcing, seasonality, and nutrition. And the way it works is pretty simple. We try to keep it very easy for our customers to place orders from us. Mm-hmm. We have one menu. It changes seasonally, and customers place an order for sizes 10 to 600, and we deliver them a group lunch that's prepared fresh daily in our kitchen the next day.
Wow. So New York City, you know better than most, is flooded with lunch options and catering companies. So what, in your opinion, differentiates Oxvert from all of the rest? What makes it stand out?
Sorry, go ahead.
I said, what makes it stand out?
I think there are a couple things that make it stand out. I think for a lot of group delivery options, it is typically you see restaurants and very good restaurants mm-hmm. who do catering kind of as a side business. And while sometimes that's successful, I think a lot of times It means that the menus and the customer service and even the presentation are not really a priority for that restaurant because they're trying to run the restaurant, and restaurants are very, mm-hmm. very difficult to run. Mm-hmm. So what we've done that's really differentiated is we have perfected all of those elements. So our menu is designed to be delivered. It's not designed to, come straight from a kitchen and go straight to your table. Mm-hmm. So the food is designed to travel. We've made the presentation a lot more appealing than your typical catering option because, we all do eat with our eyes. Mm-hmm. And we've also really made it about the customer experience and made it as easy for people to order for small and large groups as possible.
So many food businesses operate with super thin margins, right? I'm wondering how you've been able to kind of grow the company while keeping your operational costs contained, especially with your kind of commitments to sourcing locally.
Yeah, I think that is the question. And just to, give you a quick sense of the context in which I developed Oxbert, mm-hmm. I spent about 7 years in finance and also worked on the investment side with a couple of food companies and sort of came face to face with a lot of those challenges with respect to scalability and margins. And so when I decided to start Oxbert, every piece of the business was really designed with a focus on scaling at margins that were exciting. And some of the ways we think about doing that include things like we don't have brick and mortar restaurants mm-hmm. at all. So we don't have the expensive real estate or all of the people that it takes to do that, to run a bigger and mortar restaurant. We also get a lot of operating leverage out of one commissary kitchen. So instead wow. of, needing three, fast casual restaurants to serve one geographic area, all we need is one kitchen. And then we've done a lot of other interesting things to make the margins exciting, which is the simplicity of our menu and using local sourcing actually to our advantage. Mm-hmm. And so, when done properly, the idea of local sourcing and buying with the seasons is that you're actually supposed to be saving money because you're buying things when they're harvested and when they're most abundant. And so if you can kind of get ahead of that and develop your menu properly, it should be margin enhancing. I don't think any of us are quite there yet, but that is absolutely the
goal.
Way it should work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How have you found seasonality as one of your kind of big commitments? Have you found that to be challenging from a menu development perspective? Because, like, let's face it, we're in the Northeast, right? And as much as I may want avocados to grow here, they don't. But we live in a world where we expect to be able to have access to everything at any time. And so I'm wondering if you found that to be kind of a challenge from the menu development perspective for your customers.
I would say no. I think that, the one item, it's funny that you mentioned avocados. Yeah. I would say the one, genuinely, because I think the one item that is sort of universal, especially when it comes to the type of food we're serving, is avocados, and we will never be able to get those locally. But mm-hmm. I think when it comes to what is available in the Northeast, I don't think our chef or any of us have felt at all kind of limited by the options that are available in the Northeast. I think winter is probably the hardest season, mm-hmm. just because there are fewer things that grow. I would say the harder part about sourcing locally is not necessarily that the things that grow in the Northeast here are limited. It's more that you can't predict the availability. And so, you develop a menu per season, mm-hmm. each season, but there may be items that the weather's a little funny, so they come later, or they don't right. come at all, or, the supply is hard to predict. So I think that's more of a challenge, really, than the variety that we're able to get here. The Northeast has got lots of fun stuff.
Yes, that is very true. And in fact, a lot of our specialty crops, which is a term for vegetables, unfortunately, are grown in the Northeast. But there's still some that, it's never probably going to happen. But to that end, do you have specific commitments around seasonality and local sourcing that you like to tell your customer base about?
Yeah, absolutely. We are a very mission-driven organization. We're on our path to becoming a B Corp, which means that we measure our impact to mm-hmm. people, planet, and the profits. And so within that, as part of our environmental impact, we have requirements for how we will source things. So right. one of those is that everything we, 80% of anything on a menu has to be sourced from within 150 miles of us.
Wow.
So that's our kind of broad brush guideline. And yep. then kind of within there, we have developed some of our own other sourcing guidelines that have to do with the way sustainably raised animals and the way the animals are treated, but then also some standards around the way crops are taken care of with respect to pesticides and things of that nature.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier that you have a background in finance before moving over to the food industry. Do you think that, from your kind of perspective launching this company in the food world, that you really needed the experience working in the food industry prior to starting your own company? Or do you think it's not as important?
I think it's a tricky answer. I think it has historically not been as important, and that's historically what's been the problem. So huh. I think one of the reasons why until recently we haven't seen a lot of innovation in food that will lead to, I mean, we've seen a lot of creative culinary innovation, mm-hmm. but innovation around supply chain models and things that will really start getting us access to the quality and the type of foods that we all need to be eating mm-hmm. is because we didn't have a lot of blending of the traditional business world with the food world. The food world was very much, in many cases, left to be kind of a creative venture, and you could right. certainly do well with that. So I think what having a financial background has allowed me to do is create a business model that really has the potential to create change, because I'm able to apply sort of traditional, business principles and principles around cost structure and margin, mm-hmm. To an industry where a lot of that hasn't been done traditionally. I think that's changing, which is awesome. But I do think that's, the last 5 years or so is when we've really started to see that change.
Right. Okay, great. All right. Well, anything else you want to make listeners aware of before we wrap up for today?
Nothing specific. I mean, if anyone is interested in working with us, we'd love to meet new people. Uh-huh. You can just go to our website, www.oxfair.com.
Oh, great. Yes, I love, and one of the great things I think about this segment is I love featuring startups at kind of different parts of their growth, right? So we have had in the past those that have been in existence for many, many years, and those that are really in the, just have like under 10 employees and are poised to scale in the next year or so. So I love the diversity. I think that your food looks absolutely incredible. And like you said, for more information on the company and most importantly, to place your orders, oxfair.com. Thank you so much for joining me today, Jesse.
Thank you. This was great.
Thanks.
Bye.
Okay. I want to thank all of our guests today and our sponsors for your generous support. Our show is produced with help from Taylor Lanzette, and the show music is by the fabulously talented Tim Archer. I want to thank my engineer, David Tadashore, for being amazing every single week. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on Heritage Radio Network's website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. Like, share, follow, and post to us on Facebook, and find us on Twitter at Eat Matters HRN. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.